Welcome to Making Change, a podcast of the Chronicle of Philanthropy. I'm Hilde Gottlieb, author of The Pollyanna Principles and co-founder of Creating the Future, where we're changing the questions that will change the world. It is my privilege to host this podcast, where we talk with change leaders from around the world about our human potential for creating more healthy and humane places to live. I'm so pleased to welcome Brian Burns as my guest on Making Change. Brian is president and CEO of the Santa Fe Community Foundation. Prior to his work in Santa Fe, Brian served as president and CEO of the Vermont Community Foundation and managing director of the Tides Foundation. Brian also brings several decades of social activism to his foundation work, including 12 years working in a variety of AIDS service organizations, including the San Francisco AIDS Foundation and the AIDS Action Committee in Boston. Given the breadth of his experience in both the foundation world and the world of on-the-ground service, it's my pleasure to have Brian Burns share his observations with us today, here on Making Change. My guest today on Making Change is Brian Burns. Welcome, Brian.
Hi, thanks so much.
If you would share with our listeners a little bit about the meandering journey that your life has taken to get you to the place that you're at right now in terms of the change work that you're doing, we would love to know a little bit more about you.
Oh, well, thanks. You know, it's been a circuitous path. I think like many people who find themselves in philanthropy, you know, I don't think anybody kind of starts out thinking, oh, I'm going to work in philanthropy. We all kind of find ourselves there somehow. And stepping my path backwards maybe creates something that sounds linear, probably more linear than it actually was. So I've been working in community philanthropy for about 12 years. Before being here at the Santa Fe Community Foundation, I worked at Tides Foundation briefly, and before that, I was the president of the Vermont Community Foundation. And I found my way into philanthropy really because of a friend who was a consultant to the Vermont Community Foundation and who knew me from my previous work during the AIDS epidemic, and who was an organizational consultant to the San Francisco AIDS Foundation, where I used to work. And she was working to help the Vermont Community Foundation find a president. And one day she was working with me at the San Francisco AIDS Foundation, and she said, you know, you're talking the same language these people in Vermont talk about how change happens and what your values are and your vision for communities. I think you should just talk to them about this president's job. And I did, and a marriage was made, and I got into philanthropy that way. But before that, I worked for well over a decade doing AIDS work on both coasts, in Boston first and then in San Francisco, and in a number of different settings, which were very instructive and formative for me. When I first got into the AIDS epidemic, it was through activism, with myself being gay, noticing how my community of friends, my network of acquaintances were really, you know, understatement of the year, were suffering, struggling under the epidemic. And so I was early on doing some volunteer work and early activism around the epidemic. And then I got a job at Planned Parenthood doing pregnancy prevention education in alternative schools for students who were not making it in the mainstream and who were at very high risk. Right. And from that, I then got a job at the Massachusetts Department of Public Health, very quickly a fairly high up job, being the director of public information for AIDS and HIV for the state of Massachusetts. And so there I learned a lot about how the funding system works, the bureaucracy of decision-making, the policies that influence funding decisions, the kind of built-in biases that exist in governmental structures, and in fact, the unique role that government plays in creating networks of change makers. And so that was very interesting, and I was there for a number of years, and then went to AIDS Action Committee as the director of HIV prevention in Boston, and then went to the San Francisco AIDS Foundation, where I was the deputy executive director of programs, which meant overseeing all of the externally focused programs, including needle exchange programs, all of their education work, their HIV prevention work among gay men and men who have sex with men and other groups. So that was those were the AIDS years. And before that, I was in academia and the arts. I was a musician, went to New England Conservatory for my graduate work, and after that, New York University for my doctoral work in medieval musicology.
Wow.
Of all things, yeah. And before that, though, was another very formative experience for me. I was in a Roman Catholic religious order early in life. First, a couple years of quiet study of philosophy at a Benedictine monastery in southern Indiana. And then I joined the Dominican Order, which was a Roman Catholic religious order that was very much focused on social justice work. And I myself had come out of a background of urban poverty, my family working class poor folks in New York and then New Jersey. And it was not until I got to religious life that I recognized that there were groups of people coming together to try to change the conditions in communities, in all kinds of communities. So that's where I got first introduced really to social justice work. And during all that, of course, I was coming out as a gay man in the late 70s and early 80s, a very, very difficult time.
Wow. Wow.
At the beginning of the AIDS epidemic, it was horrifying and frightening. There wasn't a lot of social acceptance yet.
Right.
And so
right.
I learned there as well to make a case to the larger society that we deserve respect and acceptance and all the same rights that everybody else deserves.
Wow. You're right. It looks linear and it is weaving and bobbing, but there is definitely pieces in there, clear intent. Which leads me to ask the question that starts all of these interviews, which is through all of that breadth of everything that you've experienced, when you see change happening, what are the conditions that you see creating that change? What is it that supports and creates change?
That's such an interesting question because I wonder if it's different under different conditions. One of the things that creates change is for people to have a strong intention about what they want to see change. And so when the AIDS epidemic was growing like it was, we were very clear we wanted to end AIDS. There was nothing that got in the way of that vision, nothing whatsoever. So in that case, a kind of single-mindedness among a group of people seems really important. But I've also come over the years to think that it's not just single-mindedness, because that can kind of shut people down from seeing their options fully. You know, sometimes we get so locked into viewing the way things should be and need to be, kind of the world according to me or my group. And so I think when change really happens and it's long-term sustainable change, that it's single-mindedness combined with a kind of open-mindedness, an ability to see broadly a range of options, an ability to appreciate the perspectives of others, even though you may not agree with them initially, to be able to really understand them and listen to them, be curious about them, the ability to stop advocating a specific point of view and become curious. And those are the softer qualities that I think are necessary for change to happen.
Can you share a little bit about stop advocating and become curious? Talk about that a little bit in terms of some of the things that you've seen.
Change never unfolds the way you think it's going to, the way you think it should. You have to become flexible and nimble as new realities present themselves to you. And there are many times when change processes just get bogged down because I see things my way and you see things your way. And we're just going to never agree and we're going to be locked up in our ideologies. And so, take for example, a big thing that happened in the AIDS epidemic, realize that there was a disproportionate number of African Americans affected by HIV, was to begin to engage with the faith community around HIV prevention. Mm-hmm. And on the surface, of course, all us white activists with a sense of privilege in the world. In many cases, those were the early AIDS activists, early privileged white men,
right,
could not ever imagine embracing the black church as a potential partner to stem the epidemic. And it required a number of us, I think, to let go of a lot of our built-in mental models and assumptions and to find some common ground together. And I think it took the same reaching across the divide on the part of the black church, who saw many people in their own congregations starting to succumb. And so some very important and strong partnerships were forged and movement building occurred because people could step back a little bit, just a little bit, from their ideology.
What do you think allowed that to happen?
What allowed that to happen?
Yeah.
In that case, it was utter despair, to be honest.
Yeah.
It was unclear. We felt we were losing the battle, and we felt like we were losing the war.
Yeah.
And maybe it was time for a different strategy. That's my memory of it, is a sense that we weren't going to make it anywhere if we didn't go there together somehow. And we see this around the world. We see it in Rwanda, in the Tutsis and the Hutus, and we see it in Northern Ireland. We've seen it in places where there are some people in communities who can move beyond the me versus you mindset and begin to forgive and begin to embrace or at least reach out and shake hands across what seem to be divides that are insurmountable, that can't be crossed. So I think that's what happens, is there are just some people who say, I'm tired of digging in to this my way or the highway kind of mentality because it's ultimately futile.
You know, it's so interesting thinking of that from the perspective of foundation philanthropy. So often what we see in communities, because a traditional foundation philanthropy has required people to compete for resources, we see people sort of getting into their bunkers and fighting things out.
Yeah.
I'm curious what you've seen from that foundation perspective in terms of setting aside some of those barriers, letting go of some of those assumptions, and actually crossing those barriers.
First, let me say, philanthropy is, of course, a very valuable thing in society.
Mm-hmm.
There's no doubt that it's better to cultivate a culture of generosity than a culture of stinginess. There's just no doubt. And that said, I don't think I've told you yet, but I'm leaving my job at the Santa Fe Community Foundation actually at the end of this week.
Wow.
To live in a Zen Buddhist monastery that I've been living at for a while and to devote myself to that practice, but also thinking about Buddhist-based social justice and philanthropic work in the United States and around the globe. And also I'm kind of in that process right now, and I'm leaving traditional philanthropy with a critique. And I'm sorry to say, it's a critique I don't yet know what to do with. I don't have easy answers to it. But I do think that there are some deep fundamental flaws in the current practice of philanthropy that we can't sweep under the carpet and shouldn't look away from, but should have the courage to really address as a community of philanthropic practitioners and to speak honestly about.
Wow.
And you mentioned the competition notion, and I would say, yeah, that's definitely a problem. We are sometimes working in places where competition is not the most helpful way of operating. Cooperation and coordination would be.
Mm-hmm.
We've recognized that here in New Mexico, where the five community foundations across the state are recognizing that we are competing with one another for scarce resources. And to what end? And might it not be better if we begin to think about how we coordinate, consolidate, and possibly even merge with one another to create a different philanthropic narrative in this state than the one the competition has created. So we are thinking about that here, and we're entering into a process to explore that. And even after I leave the Community Foundation here, I'm going to be staying on with that project one day a week for the next 6 months to explore it, because
wow.
we're We're doing a really thorough kind of soul-searching type learning expedition around this, and I think that will be very beneficial because we want to look at this issue of competition on the one hand. But there are other problems as well. Working in community philanthropy, it's really wonderful that there are wealthy people who want to give, and there's no philanthropic activity without having really good nonprofits to give to. And so doing that bridging work is really valuable. And at the same time, I have always felt uncomfortable with what some people have called, like Robert Reich at Stanford, the plutocracy of philanthropy.
Right.
That we take money out of the tax system through the charitable deduction, and estimates are that's $40 or $50 billion a year in lost tax revenue. When that tax revenue were, presumably in the best of all possible worlds, if it stayed in government, might create programs that help address some of the immense human suffering that we see throughout society through food programs and homeless programs and education and special ed, and you name the long list of things that government currently supports. But right now, philanthropy takes that $50 billion a year out of the tax system, and then who gets to decide how charitable dollars get to be used, how that savings gets used? And somehow I think, especially in community philanthropy and community foundations, we have to be experimenting with ways of democratic philanthropy. I think models of democratic philanthropy as opposed to plutocratic philanthropy. Mm. How do we put the decision making for how philanthropic capital can be used down into the hands of the people most affected by the social problems that we're trying to solve?
It's really striking to me. It's a question that we have been asking actually at Creating the Future over the past several of our board meetings, which is, who owns the resources?
Yeah.
And especially in the world of philanthropy, not so much in community foundations, but especially in family philanthropy, the assumption is that our fiduciary obligation is, yes, to follow the law, but is to follow the mandate of whoever it was that initially funded the foundation. And is it our money as a foundation, or through, as you're suggesting, the fact that truly the tax exemption is coming from all of us, who owns the resource?
Right. And I think this is a very important question for us to be exploring together. These are one of the hard questions of philanthropy. And it's true you exempted community foundations, but we are not exempt from that because we are largely driven by the donor-advised fund.
Very much so.
So whose money is that? Once the donor's been rewarded with the deduction, whose money is it? And who gets to decide? And I don't think it's helpful, back to your competition to a question, to pit donors against communities. Donors are in communities.
Exactly.
They are members of community. And communities are diverse places, economically, racially, by identity, by gender, by all these different things. So I don't think the solution is some kind of Robin Hood-like approach. It's got to be something more that helps everybody come to the table with their own unique resources. Yeah. And where some kind of collective decision-making can be made, and where power doesn't get aligned with money, which is one of the fatal flaws of philanthropy. It breeds arrogance in philanthropy. It can lead to enormous waste. And it's a deep problem embedded in capitalism in many ways, that money is power.
Right.
And once you have it, you're then assumed to be the smartest person in the room.
Brian, have you seen circumstances, specific projects, examples where that is more flat than that degree of rigid hierarchy?
Well, we see it in crowdsourcing, where you're collecting money from many, many different people and everybody has a voice somehow. And we also see it in giving circles often, where you have people of different levels of ability, to give. We see it, and there's a lot of experimentation also happening in including community members in philanthropic decision making. So there is experimentation happening. But I just don't think it's at the scale that it needs to happen. And I do think, as I leave the field of community foundations, that community foundations are the place where that should and could be happening.
Yes.
embracing our role as an engaged community member and bringing other engaged community members together around the table. But there are so many barriers to us doing it. One big one is the Community Foundation business model, which I think needs a lot of revision. But as it stands now, we remain financially sustainable by, in fact, viewing donors as the client and customer.
Right.
Extracting a fee off of their donor-advised fund for our own sustainability. So there's just something fundamental there that doesn't encourage us to think about other modes of engagement, of equalizing the decision-making, of democratizing philanthropy.
As you're talking, I'm thinking about the organizations that are grant dependent for their operating because they take the 10% admin off of the top of every grant and hope and pray that that will run their organization. And it really is the same model.
Right. Yeah. Like I said, I come into it with more questions than answers about it. And I just don't think any one of us has the answer to this. But there is something, I think, wrong that all of us, and this is maybe where, you know, the council and foundations and some of the conferences maybe could begin to create venues where we can explore the deep, hard questions about the ethics of philanthropy. What is the ethical framework out of which we make our decisions? Mm-hmm. What are the economic models that inform our thinking about how we should run these institutions? You know, how do we take on this, the big question of money and power in a society where we see this growing divide everywhere? And I just don't think philanthropy should be participating in that divide. We should be standing for something different and using our independence and neutrality to step outside of the conventional ways that society works. And I would love to see more experimentation in those arenas.
How do we, in the world of philanthropy, walk the talk of the future that we want to see? If we want to see an equitable world, how do we walk that talk?
Yeah. How do we as foundation leaders? Or
yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I think the first step is to deeply reflect on the current way of doing business. And we have to create a culture of reflection at the executive and board levels of our organizations. Mm. It can't just be about maintaining letter of the law fiduciary responsibility. We have to engage in the deep philosophical and ethical questions that if we were to just step back and look for a minute, we would see them.
Yeah.
So creating space and the expectation that we engage reflectively in what we're doing has got to be a starting point.
Mm-hmm.
I think another part of it, I think about Paul Farmer's work. Maybe you're familiar with Paul Farmer's work, Partners in Health. He won one of those genius awards a number of years ago and has done this tremendous work of creating healthcare institutions in Haiti and other parts of the world,
sure,
very severely affected by infectious disease and other issues. And he's quite remarkable, and he's actually, so here we're going to blend a little bit of my old past and maybe my immediate future and philanthropy together. He was very influenced by a school of thought called liberation theology, which was a movement that came out of Central America in the 1970s to address oppressive political structures in Central America that were resulting in terrible violence and terrible poverty in these Central American countries. And one of the core principles of that philosophy or the theology is to accompany those who you want to help, to fully, wholeheartedly accompany them. And that means to live with them and experience their lives and to touch into the reality of the lives of the people you want to help and to get to know them. And to know them so well that you begin to see their perspective on the world and you begin to trust their own ability to choose a path out of suffering for themselves. And I wonder if in philanthropy we should be practicing more of this kind of accompaniment.
Wow.
To really drop in deeply to the lives of the people we say we want to help and to understand it fully.
I'm just imagining what that could make possible.
Yeah. To think about that, it levels the field in many ways very quickly. And it opens the hearts of everybody. And so often poor people look at the wealthy as the cause of the problem, and wealthy people look at poor people as somehow not living up to their obligation in
right.
society. Well, maybe we can begin to address that by just living with one another a little bit and getting to know one another. And then I think there's another practice, you know, and we see this more and more, and there's a little bit of a danger to it, but we have to know the literature that describes the problems we're trying to solve. So often in philanthropy, and I think this is true at the donor-advised fund level, I think that large foundations are more committed to making informed decisions, but most people give emotionally.
Right.
And emotionally isn't bad. You have to have heart. But you also have to have mind, kind of heart-mind going in the whole thing, and you have to cultivate a curiosity about the problems we're trying to solve, and a curiosity to view them as objectively as possible, free of the ideologies that often control our points of view in the rest of our lives. And I think this is an interesting practice field for that, philanthropy. Could we step back from the narrowing of ideological thinking and into a more boundless, expansive curiosity about what's going on out there?
It's interesting, that whole concept of being a learning organization, a learning process, a model for learning, that open curiosity, and how that applies to the assumptions about what we think we already know.
Right, exactly.
Brian, I would love to continue to explore this with you. I feel like we're just getting started on a fabulous conversation, but what is really striking to me is how consistently that whole balance, again, between living in people's shoes and yet having that objective, that curiosity about the objective facts in the matter, really comes back down to the two things that you started with, which was having a clear vision of what you want to accomplish, but really also having the open-mindedness to embrace the things that you may have assumptions about. So thank you so much for exploring this with us today. This has been absolutely fascinating, and I wish you very, very good luck in what is next.
Hilary, thank you so much for having me and your interest. It was a really wonderful pleasure to talk with you.
Speaking with Brian, I'm struck by how his own exploration about foundations and philanthropy reflects his opening comments, that change requires not only clear intention, but the willingness to question dogma. In Brian's words, the willingness to stop advocating and to become curious. In the language of entrepreneurship, one might call that a pivot, keeping your eye on the prize while adjusting the means to achieve those ends. The questions Brian is setting out to explore about philanthropy might be one of the greatest examples of that pivot concept. For 12 years, he's been part of a world that has a pretty clearly defined purpose of supporting healthy communities. But the means they use to accomplish those ends are not set in stone. Boards have the authority, perhaps even the moral imperative, to be more than just fiduciary guardians of legal obligations. The leaders of effective organizations keep asking those bigger questions. They spend time thinking out loud together. They're always learning, and the organization's actions benefit from that time spent in reflection, which, Brian points out, is rare in any organization and especially rare in the world of foundation philanthropy. How many foundations take the example of Paul Farmer to heart, living with the people they're helping, experiencing their lives from their perspective? How many boards create the space for reflection, for thinking out loud together? And what would it make possible if all foundations saw that not as a luxury, but as their job? As Brian noted repeatedly, it all comes down to the assumptions each of us brings to our work and to our lives. which leads to questions for your own work. First, is your organization clear about its vision? If successful change depends on clear intention and vision, does everyone in your organization, from the board to the line staff to the volunteers, share a vision for success? If your organization were 100% successful, what would life in your community be like? And is everyone in your organization working with that as their true north? Second, what systems are in place to instill flexibility and learning into your work? What mechanisms do you have to ensure that you're not just advocating the same thing over and over, as Brian noted, but staying curious? What systems are embedded in the workflow of your board and staff to ensure that ongoing learning is part of the job? And most importantly, what mechanisms are in place for applying what you learn to the work, making it applicable versus just an academic exercise? And lastly, to what degree do your organization's leaders routinely question their assumptions about the shoulds, the ways organizations and boards should operate, the things organizations should measure, the things they should do? Outside of a small handful of legal obligations, none of those other shoulds are set in stone. What would it make possible if every time someone used the word should, you substituted the word might, moving from we should do that to we might do that? What possibilities could that open up for your work? As you begin exploring these big questions, I hope you'll share your observations at Creating the Future's Facebook page at facebook.com/creatingthefuture. We hope you've enjoyed this edition of Making Change. If you have ideas for guests for this podcast, folks who are driving new ways of thinking about what it takes to create visionary social change, please get hold of me through our website at creatingthefuture.org or on Twitter at Hilde Gottlieb. Thanks for listening and for wanting to create a better future for your community and our world. For Creating the Future and the Chronicle of Philanthropy, I'm Hilde Gottlieb. We'll see you next month here on Making Change.